depending on where you are in the world. And welcome to Information Week Live for the week of October 30th, 2016. Boy, the weeks are just counting down. Fortunately, there's still lots and lots to talk about in the world of IT, and we're glad you're here to talk about them with us. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Technology at Information Week, and today I'm joined by one of our regulars here at Information Week Live, and, well, one of my favorite guests. We've got Sarah Peters, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. That's our sister site that concentrates on security and all things frightening in the enterprise. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Now, before we went on the air, Sarah and I were talking about, well, exactly what we were going to talk about this week. I mean, you know, it's not been a week when we've seen huge security stories break. It's not been a week when we saw huge things break in terms of new products or new services in the industry. So I want to look at something that I've been talking about a lot with other people and haven't really talked about it a lot here on the air. That's digital transformation. You know, at the recent Gartner conference, a lot of people were talking about digital transformation and basically using it in the context of changing processes, changing the tools used for processes from paper or other traditional physical manifestations into digital forms. And one of the reasons that I'm excited to have Sarah here today is that in many cases we're seeing the security of an organization be digitized, or to use the form that they often use at Gartner, digitalized, in that things like physical access control is now tied into something like your Active Directory account. And so, Sarah, you know, the whole digitalization or digitization means that we're seeing computers take over many more things, including what most of us call the IoT. I mean, from your perspective, are there huge security implications here, or is it just sort of a straight line growth of all the computer security that we've been dealing with for the past 30 years?
Oh, God. Well, first of all, can I just express my distaste with the word digitalization? Ugh. It's too long, and I just don't like all of these ization words. I've never liked ization words, but digitalization is just too long. So no thanks to Gartner for that one. I think this is not a good trend. Here's the reason why it's so troublesome. Paradoxically, security, the physical security industry happens to be possibly the worst at cybersecurity. So those things like, for example, your CCTV cameras, once they, you know, you connect them with some kind of monitoring tool or something like that, all of those home surveillance cameras, those kinds of things, are notorious for just appallingly bad cybersecurity. They just make rookie mistakes over and over again. And that's typical. It's not unsurprising that we see cybersecurity mistakes in IoT devices. We see them in all kinds of IoT devices. It just seems like some of the worst examples happen in physical security. So hearing that there's even more in this direction, that we're instead of having physical locks, we're moving to more access control, if it's not just adding some physical access control with fingerprint scanners and stuff, but actually replacing physical locks with all of these things. Some of the technologies are very advanced. Others, I think, are probably we're overly relying on them. So I would say that we've got to proceed carefully because the technologies that we could be instituting widely vary in the degree of security that they could actually bring to the party.
Okay, you use the phrase rookie mistakes, and I know what you mean there. These are, you know, what to keep the sports metaphors going, I would call the failure of basic blocking and tackling, you know, getting the stuff right.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, from where you sit and from what you've seen, is the real fault in the intrinsic design of all of these IoT pieces, including the IoT pieces that are supposed to be physical security, or is it a failure of the users, the end users of those devices, to properly configure them, to make the rookie mistakes like leaving them with the default passwords and usernames, things like that?
Number one, we can never get into the habit of blaming our end users, because that is a cop-out. It's something that some security people have done for years, and we just got to get out of that habit. It's just a cop-out. But in this particular case, I just don't think it's accurate, that a lot of these kinds of problems are things that happen at the manufacturer level. Just changing the default password on something isn't really going to fix the problems. They're errors that are being made on the, you know, down in the with the protocols, really. There's certain things that a user could not fix on their own. The machines are just wide open to man-in-the-middle attacks and that kind of thing. So that's why over the years you've seen stuff like a baby monitor being exploited so that a remote attacker can actually see what is – they can actually hack into a baby monitor and see what is happening to your baby, that kind of thing. I mean, there's been some really creepy stuff that's happened over the years, and that we've got to blame on the manufacturers of the hardware, sometimes the manufacturers of the hardware, but mostly on the middleware. There's a number of players involved in these kinds of devices too, because you've got a lot of components involved. So there's a question of which component was the one that was at fault, and was something fine when it left? Was the component okay when it left my house and somehow got screwed up when it got combined with a component from somebody else's house? And whose job is it to do the testing? How many stops along the road does it need to undergo more testing? There's a lot of questions on how all of the security testing and the whole process needs to go forward, and it just hasn't been implemented. There's safety testing that happens a lot of times, but not the same cybersecurity testing, and that's where we've got to get to.
Okay, now in what you're saying, several times you referred to things like baby monitors and houses and other consumer products, and boy, do we know how those can be used by hackers. We've seen it recently. I think first and most publicly in the DDoS attack that was launched against Krebs, and then there have been some others as well. But now, isn't it the case that consumers are one problem? I mean, it's a huge problem, but it's one problem. Do you see business being any better? I mean, when businesses use intelligent light bulbs, when businesses use intelligent thermostats and all of these other things, do you think that businesses are getting the security on those things better than the consumers are, or is it still a huge issue when these things are being implemented at a local retail store or a local garage or whatever the business might be?
I don't think that. And again, some of the things are not things that could necessarily be easily fixed by the user, whoever that user might be. But other things, I think there's still a lack of awareness about just how powerful some of these smart devices are. I mean, I know I've mentioned on this show before my astonishment a couple months ago when I interviewed somebody who said that he did a penetration test at an organization and was able to hack his way into a confidential database by first compromising a smart coffee pot at the organization, which is just, I mean, it is, it's astonishing that that's something that could happen. You just don't plan on setting up your perimeter defenses thinking about having to protect a database from a coffee pot. There's just, you don't think about that yet. It's the same you're not thinking about your coffee pots. Your most businesses are not thinking so much about even the smart TVs that they have set up in their conference rooms. They're starting, a lot of them, to think about the risks of something like a smart TV. But still, I would say that that's not the norm quite yet. I'm hoping that's going to improve.
Well, okay. I hope that it improves too. I'm hoping a lot of things these days, most of which we're not going to talk about here on Information Week Live, because they've... But I will say that I find it interesting that what we're doing as we're adding intelligence to so many aspects of our environment is opening up these different aspects to be used not only to our benefit, but as tools against our neighbors, against our own business interests. And it seems like we've seen, to some extent, an issue that plagued industrial process control for a long time come into the Internet of Things. I remember talking to industrial process control engineers 20 years ago when they were just starting to put some of these industrial process systems on the Internet. I would ask them about things like security, and they laughed because their whole point of view was twofold. One, that they weren't going to advertise that these things were on the Internet. They believed deeply in the whole security through obscurity concept, which to me is one of the bigger shams out there. And second, they had the attitude of, well, why would anyone want to hack this system? You know, there's no cash involved. They can't do anything. Why would someone use it? And we're now getting a very clear sense of why someone might want to hack it, because they can use it as a node in a network that ultimately generates huge volumes of traffic to be used against one of their enemies. But when you talk, when I talk to people about, you know, intelligent light bulbs, why would anyone want to hack a light bulb? What could possibly be their motive? Now we know. And once again, I come back to this over and over and over again. Our biggest failures in security are not failures of technology. They're failures of imagination. We just can't imagine that someone would be so nefarious as to use this against us. And I think that, you know, what we ultimately are going to have to do is just pretend that there's an entire army of Moriartys out there that are going to be trying to outwit our resident Sherlocks. Do you think I'm way off base on this?
Do you have
a more optimistic or more pessimistic view?
I don't. I think that you found the perfect way of putting it, actually. And that's one of the things about this job that sometimes I find exhausting, is because I think to myself, well, what the heck are they going to come up with tomorrow? Because the thing that seems so highly unlikely on Thursday is the thing that happens Friday. And like you said, it does seem to be on our end. We just couldn't imagine that somebody would, either we think that nobody would want to do something, or it never would have occurred to us that such a thing could happen, that anybody would have been able to come up with something like that crazy. And also, there is still there really still is in the security world a real excitement about just being able to do something, for just to be able to do it. And I don't know how much of a role that always plays. I couldn't tell you, I couldn't quantify that for you, but we don't know right now. For example, the attacks last week that brought down Twitter and Pinterest and CNN and AWS, you know, we don't know exactly, was there a purpose in that? Was that just a test attack? And if it was, what was it a test for? Was it actually to take somebody down, or was it sort of an advertisement for some attack as a service so that some group could sell that service to somebody else, et cetera, et cetera? Was it ultimately financially motivated or nation state motivated, et cetera, et cetera? Was it a practice test for the election next week? I mean, we can speculate in whatever way we want, but did it ultimately, was it inspired by somebody just saying, hey, I bet we could do this thing if we just worked on it for a little while? I do think there is an academic curiosity and a yen for just kicking up trouble, the heart of a lot of the problems we have in cybercrime. And there are some times that you come across people we ultimately consider cyber criminals that, you know, you'll hear stories about them, you'll read interviews with them, or you will interview them, and you'll realize that some of these people don't consider themselves criminals because they won't even have quite, they just have a different understanding of, just have a different way of looking at the world. And it becomes very difficult to know how to fight that kind of, it's very hard to fight that kind of system when you are trying to, but you, when it's, when you don't really know how to predict that kind of threat, because you can't imagine the sorts of amazing and terrible things. You can't imagine the sorts of things that they'll come up with, and you can't imagine the sorts of ways that somebody will use their brilliant imagination.
Well, I think that we have. Oh, it is creepy out there, and we've certainly seen that people do have imaginations that run in all sorts of interesting and terrifying directions. So, you know, as we're talking about this whole digitalization, the word that you hate, and digitization, so maybe you'll make it about 10% less. One of the things that I keep hearing more and more is about basically security as a service, that, you know, this is something where the bad guys are getting so good so fast and are, you know, we're basically always in catch-up mode in security, that the rational thing to do is turn it all over to the people who are pros and let them worry about it, and, you know, basically just throw yourself on their mercy. How big is security as a service getting? Are you writing a lot about it? Are you hearing a lot about it? Is it becoming more than just a panacea for the very small customer?
Yeah, it is becoming more. It's for more than just the small guy now, because the need is just too big. There's too much data. There's too much threat intelligence data out there for a lot of companies to even begin to look at. And also, there's too much of a need for security people, and too few security people to go around. So you kind of need to share talent. And if you can just go to a service provider who has all of these minds and technology working together, there is a lot of benefit that you can get from that. So it's not just for the mom and pop shops anymore, not at all.
Well, this is the point in our conversation when I usually turn to you and say, okay, well, now we've talked about all the horrible stuff. We've talked about how very bad things are. What is the ray of sunshine that we can look to give us all hope that everything's going to be just peachy in the long run? Got anything?
Well, let's see. I can tell you that it always sort of has a bittersweetness when I talk about people who've been convicted for various cyber crimes. So I don't know if that qualifies or not. Does that qualify as a ray of sunshine? Or if I talk about different how about a tool for some cybersecurity job hunters that was launched that would help people land their best gig? Does that help?
I like that.
There's a new place, a new company called it's a new tool called CyberSeek. That is, like I was just talking about, there is this major skills shortage that we talk incessantly about in the security world. So this is something that NIST is actually behind, with also the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education. So CyberSeek is to assist both students, employees, employers, policymakers, everybody, to try to narrow down that employment gap. And one of the cool things about it is that it's got this this career pathway that has some details on salaries and job openings and job statistics, and supposed to help those early career job candidates find the right position for them. And one of the things we've really struggled with is to find that security job? What is that first thing that will get you on the right path? So hopefully this will help out. So that's a little bit of good news.
It is a little bit of good news.
It doesn't entirely help.
Well, but it's a step in the right direction. And I will say that while it's been rather a long time since I had my first job, I have a son who is not long out of university, is employed, but would really like to have a job in his area of technology. So he's working on that. So I understand where the struggle is on these first jobs, even if you've got credentials. It's not a question of, gee, if you go to college and get the right degree, then everything's going to be sunshine and happiness for you. It still takes some work. And I think that especially in the area of security, anything that can help people get that first job is a really, really good thing.
That is true, because we need them. We need them.
That we do. And I'll tell you what, this is a place that I will, in fact, get on a soapbox a bit. I think
do
we
it.
Need people from different backgrounds. We need people. We need more women. We need more people who are from parts of the world, not North America. Why? Because they bring different perspectives. And the thing that I was talking about, the failure of imagination, one of the ingredients in curing that failure of imagination is bringing people with different imaginations into the field. When we can pool all of these various experience bases, when we can pool all of these cultural experiences, we get much better solutions on the whole. And so I think that will be really good for us if we can make that happen.
Beautifully said, and I completely agree. And you know, I think that there are some people in the field who have some people who have argued for the same, and yet there's a resistance because everybody wants the best security people, and that means that they're looking for they're looking for a certain amount of credentials and a certain amount of experience that you're not always going to find, because to a large degree, it's a relatively nascent field. There's just not that many people who have 25 years of experience in cybersecurity. They're just not out there. And also, you know, if we just limit ourselves to people who are, there's just so many limitations that everybody's putting on themselves, just looking for people with these deep, deep technological backgrounds. We need to be looking for more diversity just in the kinds of, educational backgrounds that people have as well. Otherwise, this gap is never, ever going to close. So I'm with you entirely.
Well, especially on the educational diversity, as the guy with a bachelor's degree in art, I could not agree more. I think that we need lots of diversity here. Well, Sarah, as hard as it is to believe, we have talked for nearly the entire half hour of Information Week Live, and I think it's been a great conversation. This is the kind of conversation I love, where we get to share thoughts from our different points of view, when we get to bring different ideas into the subject. And I tell you one that I would like to have, and I want to bring some of our colleagues in as well. You brought it up in terms of hiring. That's that whole notion of credentials. The difference between education or experience and credentials, I think, is an important one. It's one that I would like to do a whole show on. And when I do, I hope that you'll join me, because I think you have some really great things to add to that conversation.
I would be delighted.
Well, before then, I know that you are going to be busy over at Dark Reading. Can you give us a hint of what we can look for from you in the coming week, or what you've got up on Dark Reading now that folks should go and take a look at?
Well, in the not too distant future, we're going to, of course, be thinking about all of that good retail stuff, since we are heading into the holiday shopping season, and there is lots of stuff to talk about with point of sale security and preparing, making those last minute preparations for your online stores and all of that stuff. So some of that will definitely be coming your way. Now I'm working on the interop schedule, even though interop is months and months away, and it's a difficult job. There's some really great submissions that we had for interop this year, so I'm excited about that as well.
Well, interop is certainly new. Last week here on Information Week Live, our Information Week's editorial director, Susan Nunziata, and I talked a bit about some of the changes that are taking place at interop and the changes that are taking place at Information Week in relation to interop. So it is something that's keeping a lot of us very busy. One of my big contributions, I'm putting together a whole new series of podcasts for interop. For the work that you're doing, once again, I know that you are awfully busy on social media. How can people keep up with you and keep track of what you're doing?
Well, the easiest place to find me is on Twitter, and that's at Sarah Peters. That's just no H in Sarah. And then I know that you're going to mention it, so I might as well mention it myself, that if you want to know anything that I think about basketball, you can follow me on my other Twitter account, which is at 3 from the 7. And that's it.
Sarah,
but how do we find you,
is,
Kurt?
Well, for me,
that's
you can find
really
me. You can find me on Twitter at KG4GWA. And when you do that, you will keep up with what I'm doing, which includes something that's going to go up probably sometime over the weekend or maybe on Monday. Today, Intel released video of a demonstration they did with a fleet of 500 synchronized drones. This is 500
Ooh.
Drones under the control of a single programmatic operator. And, of course, they've had to do things like get all kinds of FAA waivers to make that happen. But I quickly got on the phone and had a conversation with Anil Nanduri, who is vice president and general manager of Intel's UAV segment. And we talked about their entire drone program and something that he has referred to, and that is drones as a new compute platform. So I think that's I really enjoyed the conversation. He had a lot of interesting things to say. That will be up in a podcast form as part of Information Week's ongoing series, Information Week's Expert Voice. So be looking for that and for the other stuff. I managed to keep my fingers in a lot of different pies, and there are going to be some new podcasts up regarding interop, so stay tuned for those. Well, Sarah, thank you so much. I always appreciate you being here, and we also appreciate everyone for listening. You know, as much as I enjoy talking with Sarah, we could not and would not do the shows if it weren't for you, our listeners. Now, if you're listening to this in podcast or streaming form, we appreciate it. But want to remind you that this show does happen live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern. There's a text chat that happens alongside it at informationweek.com. We would love to have your voice in that text chat. So look us up on informationweek.com. Find us at iTunes or Google Play, and be on the lookout, because we'll be back next week at this same time. Until then, for Sarah Peters, I'm Kurt Franklin. Thanks so much for being with us. See you next week.